Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies and protocols. I talk about what worked for me, but also those big epic fails I've made along the way, and all because I genuinely believe the teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And one of the things we talk about often on this podcast is technology. We've talked about what it means to be creative and spark creativity and curiosity in a generative age. We've talked about what it means for students to be creative as they navigate the maze of an uncertain future. We've talked about AI, we've talked about vintage innovation, and now we're talking about this idea of low-tech learning. What does it mean to use technology ethically? What's going on in the so-called tech lash that we're seeing? And really, how does this fit into our current understanding of learning? So we're doing a summer series right now called Low Tech Learning. And I want to be very clear, I love technology. I am someone who uses it often. I am someone who nerds out on it. I am a big fan of tech. But I also see it as a powerful tool. And so we need to use it ethically and wisely. And there is a reason we should be thinking about what it means to embrace low-tech approaches. So that's what we're going to be talking about right now, this idea of low-tech learning. And to get there, we're going to talk about the benefits of going low-tech. What the revival of Barnes & Noble can teach us about Gen Z and technology. For years, educational technology has promised to make learning faster, more personalized, more efficient. And on some level, it really has delivered with those promises. But as concerns about screen time and student engagement continue to grow, more educators are rediscovering the value of low-tech learning. And that's what we're going to talk about. I want to be very clear. This is not a call to abandon technology or return to some imagined golden age of education. Instead, it's an invitation to think more carefully about the tools and the experiences we create. We're going to start with a story of switching to a low-tech project. There's a quiet buzz permeating the room as students jot down ideas, sketch out diagrams of concepts, and get lost in the articles that they're reading. This is hands-on and tactile. One girl carefully cuts out a paragraph from a magazine article and she places it on this continuum she's made, showing the difference between differing views on environmental impact of AI. Another draws an arrow by an infographic and jots down his thoughts on its accuracy. Still another student uses colored pencils to construct a flowchart connecting to an article he has just read. On the surface, this is low-tech. But then I notice certain students have typed up articles or created infographics using Canva. Many of the articles were printed off the internet, though most are actually physical copies from magazines. The students are working on their ongoing choice-based commonplace book project. I know that sounds odd, but let me explain what a commonplace book is. For centuries, people kept commonplace books as a way to collect quotes and ideas and questions and observations all in this like hub that was a book. Rather than organizing information into cute, neat little categories, I guess they would never be cute, but neat little categories. I mean, the categories could be cute, but let's keep going. These books functioned as hubs for curiosity. People would capture whatever resonated with them and would often make connections between ideas. They often wrote their own original works or created mashups as well. In many ways, commonplace books were less about storing information and more about cultivating deeper thinking as patterns and insights and new ideas emerged through reflection. So this teacher has taken a really old idea and brought it back to life in the classroom. She's actually connected to a group of people who do this for fun. She'd read about it on Reddit, and she was like, I'm going to make my own commonplace books, because that's what we do when we're teachers. We do things like that. If you're picturing an interactive notebook, that's close, but it's not quite it. A commonplace book is much messier. Students create their own internal logic and organizational structure. It is very self-directed. There are some occasional prompts that the teacher might use, but mostly she provides parameters rather than prompts. Now, commonplace books take on a sort of content curation where students find resources, they organize them, they offer commentary. So there's this active act of curation. And if you remember, I've talked about this before, curation is vital in an age of AI, because not only do we need to create, but we need to do a really good job of developing our tastes, blending together new ideas, thinking divergently, and that's part of what curation actually does. But it also includes original work that they create. Each student must add instructional, expository, and argumentative pieces that they either wrote out by hand or that they typed and then printed. These books are deeply personal, offering a chance for students to explore their tastes, examine new ideas, and find their voice in a way that feels personal. However, they also include this social dynamic as well. Students leave comments on each other's commonplace books. Each author curator can either allow for sticky notes, and some of them have multicolored sticky notes fanning through their books, and it looks really cool but really messy, or they leave space in the margins of their work for peer comments. A few students have created shared commonplace books where they share the specific book and then they rotate who is in charge of each one. In the end, the commonplace books function as a tool for making connections, helping students turn information into insight through reflection and curiosity. Now, this project is a sharp departure from the combined Geek Out Blogs and curation project that their teacher, named Melissa, had done in previous years. From a learning standpoint, this project still has all the same components with the same standards and competencies. But this is a very different project. This is a low-tech version, and it's a sharp departure from previous years. She described it to me this way. Honestly, students were writing in a way that felt too formulaic. I was battling the challenge of AI-generated writing, not because my students were lazy or even apathetic. They were just so busy. But also, they were wanting something more private than blogging. The result was something much more lively, if a bit chaotic. Assessment proved a challenge at first, as she had to combine self-reflection with conferencing, with a rotation of days where she would collect their books. The way she describes it again is, some of them got kind of attached to their books, and they worked on them at home. So there was this frustration of not having them for a few days. There was also the challenge of having additional classroom magazines, sticky notes, and going through a lot of printer ink. High-tech solutions are often less expensive. But for her, this project was proof that many students wanted something low-tech. And I think we're actually seeing this as a trend with Gen Z, or even Gen Alpha, perhaps. Why iPad kids are embracing low-tech. Our local Barnes & Noble is so packed with Gen Z kids that I hear a woman say to her friend, I haven't been to Barnes & Noble in years. I didn't know. I just didn't know so many teenagers love to read. It makes my retired English teacher heart happy. Her friend nods and whispers, look, he's choosing Brave New World. Remember when we did that dystopian unit with The Maze Runner and The Hunger Games? The other woman lets out a verbal giggle, and I can't help but smile. I glance around the store. Students are debating which manga is better. Others are saying, hey, have you checked out this album near the record collection? They're popping in earbuds to see if they should buy a record. Note, I personally think a listening station would be really cool at Barnes & Noble. So maybe if you work at Barnes & Noble, just take up that idea. Kids sit across from each other in those big comfy chairs, eating muffins and reading books. And in this moment, I feel transported back to my own high school experience. My city, Salem, Oregon. We're not an anomaly. At a time when many experts predicted the death of bookstores, Barnes & Noble has experienced an unexpected resurgence. They're currently rolling out 60 new stores across the U.S. just this year. Part of this success comes from a renewed interest in physical books, but it also reflects something much deeper. Many members of Gen Z, who have spent their entire lives in digital spaces, seem to be seeking out places that feel tangible and social and real. Bookstores offer a different kind of experience in an era where it's hard for teenagers to find a third place. People can browse shelves, they can discover books by chance, they can flip through the pages and spend time in a shared space without the pressure to buy something immediately. But I think it's bigger than that. In an increasingly online world, the appeal of Barnes & Noble suggests that convenience isn't always the highest value. Sometimes people crave spaces that are slower and more tactile. We can talk about generative AI. It's an amazing technological advancement. We can talk about the future of virtual reality. But I also want to recognize that a generation of so-called digital natives are sometimes looking back at the old world and asking, what did we lose and how do we get that back? It's almost like coming out of COVID, so many of them said, yeah, I can inhabit a space of ones and zeros, but I want my feet planted firmly on the ground. So many of them, after growing up with an iPad in their hands, are wanting to see what life looks like beyond the screen. In a world of mind-blowing compression, where we can listen to nearly every artist on demand, I see a desire, a thirst for decompression, for slow, for tangible, for an album playing where you can't choose to skip it even if you tried. I see it in the number of youth who are going to musicals or sporting events or, yes, even bookstores. So let's look at the benefits of low tech. And I want to point out again, I am not anti-tech here. We're just going to focus on what's the upside of low tech. Number one, low tech options can actually mean more freedom and choice for students. It feels a bit counterintuitive, but low tech options often allow for more freedom and flexibility. This is odd because programs and apps tend to provide us with more tools and more choices than their low tech counterparts. But along the way, they also have more guardrails. So we end up with high tech providing choices, but low tech allowing for more freedom. Consider a blog versus a commonplace book. When I blog, I can edit on the fly. I can share my work with the world. I can find visuals from anywhere. I can embed multimedia. On this very deep level, it feels like I can have my own newspaper or magazine, which I know it sounds weird. That was a childhood dream of mine. I love my blog. I wrote a blog and now I get to record a podcast, and that is so cool. But then there's this other level. I can't as easily move text to different locations. I can't draw arrows between ideas or move snippets around. Could I do this on some type of digital tool? I'm sure I could. But it wouldn't be as easier or as precise as a commonplace book. So the lack of options here actually honestly leads to a certain freedom that I might not get in blogging. Number two, low-tech options can help with divergent thinking. As we think about this idea of fewer options leading to more freedom, there's an underlying notion of creative constraint. Sometimes fewer options actually lead to more creativity. And that's because low-tech options push us to think divergently. We end up finding creative solutions when we have these limitations. We might limit our materials in a maker challenge, and then students come up with novel solutions. But also the freedom of lo-fi options can help spark divergent thinking as well. So not only is it the limitations, but the freedom that's inherent with having something simpler, that leads to divergent thinking. Low-tech materials often lead to more divergent thinking because they're less scripted and more open-ended. A cardboard box can become a castle, a spaceship, a marble run. A notebook can become a sketchbook, a journal, a design portfolio, or a place to collect questions. When students use sticky notes to map ideas across a wall or build prototypes with craft supplies, they're not choosing from a menu of predetermined options. Instead, they're inventing possibilities. And ironically, the tools with the fewest features often provide the greatest creative freedom because students are free to imagine what the tool might actually be. So again, number one, low-tech options mean more freedom. Number two, it helps spark divergent thinking. Number three, low-tech options are more concrete. In academic circles, it's easy to forget that we are all multisensory mammals who learn through seeing, hearing, feeling, smelling, and tasting. Before anything hits our long-term memory, we process information with our sensory memory. To be clear, we still need to think abstractly. We wrestle with ideas on a regular basis, and each brain is unique, right? So for example, some people, when they read, they do not picture what they read. Others see it as a basically running, ongoing movie. The challenge is that technology tends to become more abstract as it grows more precise and efficient. Consider the clock. A sundial isn't that accurate, but it's a clear reminder that time is connected to the earth and the sun. If we think of an hourglass, we can watch time passing in a very visual, almost visceral way. Meanwhile, the tick, tick, ticking of a clock is a bit more abstract. We see precise numbers and we watch the movement, but the quantity of time is lost on us. And now we move to a digital clock. The movement, it's entirely gone. The precision, amazing. Our clocks are now synchronized, which means you can't say like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm 5 minutes late. My watch was behind. Nope, that doesn't work anymore. But all of this means that time has become increasingly abstract. As a notion of thinking about time, we don't see it as spatial or as movement or as a quantity that is consumed. So as I think about learning, the low-tech options allow for something a bit more concrete. We can see this with students doing prototype with cardboard rather than moving straight into digital modeling. If we want students to iterate in what they already create, this low-tech option allows for more freedom, previous point, but also a more concrete form of revision that students can actually see firsthand. Number four, low-tech options are often more developmentally appropriate. Young children learn best when ideas are concrete, tangible, and connected to the physical world around them. Piaget famously described children in this age as being in the concrete operational stage. Here they make sense of ideas and concepts through hands-on experiences rather than abstract reasoning. Some nuance here. Researchers have clearly since then revised and challenged aspects of Piaget's theory. I'm not trying to say it's still valid. Kids don't move through childhood in this like lockstep formula or stages. And human development itself is much more fluid and context dependent than a series of fixed stages. But I think still the broader insight holds. Children often understand ideas more deeply at a younger age when they can manipulate objects, observe patterns, draw pictures, build models, and engage directly with their environment. In a world filled with increasingly abstract digital experiences, low-tech learning can provide the concrete foundation that young learners need. An iPad is essentially an entertainment device designed for adults. Every app has been socially engineered to maximize attention. It's pre-programmed, offering the illusion of freedom by giving more options and features. And it is inherently abstract. There's nothing physical to manipulate. So we have this situation where many children spend hours of unsupervised time using these powerful, abstract, addicting devices in their most formative years, when really they should be coloring, drawing, playing with blocks, engaging in pretend play with dolls, looking at insects, all of those things. To be fair, I don't judge a parental figure for occasionally letting their child use a tablet or watch videos or play games. Plane rides are ridiculously loud and uncomfortable, and people are quick to judge a child for being too loud. So I'm not surprised when a parent lets a kid play with an iPad for 2, 3, 4, 7, 9 hours, whatever the plane ride is. But I do think the cultural reckoning with children and screen time is a positive thing. We need to recognize that tablets aren't developmentally appropriate. I want to see students use physical manipulatives and solve problems on paper instead of hopping onto an adaptive learning math program. Does this mean that we need to ban tablets from schools entirely? Nah, I don't think so. Some of the anti-screen backlash, often called the techlash, fails to recognize the moments when tablets work really well. For example, children should read physical books, but there are some cases where adaptive learning phonics programs work really, really well. Number 5, low-tech options are less distracting. For well over a decade, teachers have complained that students were playing games, doing instant messaging, or watching YouTube videos on their Chromebooks rather than typing in a Google document. I'm not surprised by this. I'm writing right now in Apple Pages with my Wi-Fi turned off and my phone on the other side of the room because I know that I need to hit hyperfocus in my writing, but I am way too easily distracted. And now in this moment, what I just wrote, I'm now reading aloud because that's how this podcast works. It's kind of reading and riffing. And the same thing, I have my Wi-Fi turned off so I don't get distracted while I record a podcast. And here's the wild thing. I love to write. I love to talk. I love to make my podcast. I enjoy wrestling with ideas and sharing insights. I love the mental challenge of writing. But when I get stuck, I find myself wanting to scroll Instagram and see if anyone has sent me a funny reel. If I have my browser open, the urgency of email shouts out at me from my pinned tabs. I'm a huge fan of Cal Newport's deep work, and included deep work is one of the key competencies in my book, Vintage Innovation, that came out like 6, 7 years ago. Similarly, I found the notion of digital minimalism to be a strong correction to the hype of high tech. And I love this idea so much that slow productivity was cited multiple times in my book, The Depth Advantage. When I was writing the book, The AI Roadmap, I talked about the deeply human skills that we will need. And I mentioned why being off screen and actually not using AI often would help them develop the skills that they would need in an AI-saturated world. In a world of incessant distractions, our students will need to develop the habit of deep focus and deep work and deep problem solving. Low-tech options can allow us to develop this type of sustained focus. For years, when teachers complained about tech distractions, they were told by experts to simply, quote, be more engaging. But if we, as adults, struggle with this type of focus in the work that we're doing, where we are fully engaged, where we actually want it, where we might be getting paid to do it, is it any wonder that students choose games or videos over cognitively demanding assignments? A highly engaging assignment alone will not prevent distractions. It is not a cop-out when a teacher says, we are going low tech on this assignment because I want my students to avoid distractions. There is nothing wrong with going low tech to prevent the incessant temptation toward distraction. In future articles, I'll be covering, and in future podcast episodes, I'll be covering how we can use technology centered on a singular function. I'll be talking about the benefits of things like a Kindle Paperwhite or a digital notebook. But I really believe that the less tech we have, the fewer distractions we end up with. Number six, low-tech options help us avoid dopamine crashes. Earlier this year, I did a podcast episode about this idea of helping students learn how to focus. I think it's a vital skill in our current age. When I wrote The Depth Advantage, I took the deeper learning competencies, I rewrote them, I reworked them, and I actually added focus as the top one, the first one. Because I think you can't have mastery and problem solving, curiosity, self-direction. You can't have true resilience or collaboration, and you won't develop better communication skills if you cannot focus. For me, focus is the most important. It's what stands there as something that is desperately needed in a distracted world. But part of the challenge is that students have a hard time focusing because they are in the short-term dopamine process. So what happens is there's a stimulus, a TikTok video, for example. They get this quick, immediate dopamine boost, momentary happiness, and then a crash. And then they seek out the stimulus again. And this is a sharp contrast to long-term dopamine releases, where it moves slower, doesn't peak as high, but also lasts longer. We get those long-term dopamine releases in things like playing sports, learning an instrument, deep conversations, or being out in nature. So as we think about technology in school, there's a danger in spending hours using adaptive learning programs that mimic social media. Students get short-term dopamine boosts when they get the right answer, but they don't learn how to spend hours reading and writing and wrestling with ideas. In the end, I still believe learning should be blended. We still need high-tech and low-tech options. But I think it's time we ask, what do we default to on a regular basis? And embrace the benefit of low-tech options. I think we're in a place where we need to say, maybe both the quality and the quantity matter when it comes to technology. Maybe we should be using it in a better way, but we should also be using less of it at the same time. And so that's what we're exploring this summer. Again, I am a techie, but I think what we need to look at right now is what's happening with screens, what's happening with tech, and how do we help students use technology ethically and use it less. And these are some of the benefits that we see with our low-tech options. Hey, thank you for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a huge favor? Would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or I think it might be on Audible even, I'm not sure. Wherever you get your podcasts, would you leave a review? Would you subscribe? That'll help ensure that it shows up every time I post a new podcast episode. And then tell a colleague about it, or a friend, or a frenemy. I mean, that's totally fine too. You can connect with the frenemy down the hall. And let them know about this podcast if you enjoy it. Thank you again for listening. Have a wonderful day, and go out and make something awesome.